Go study old companies. Learning from brands that were started 10 years ago in those golden years of Facebook ads, that is not who you should learn from. You want to learn from people who had to learn how to market product before Facebook made it dumb shit easy? Because now the toy is kind of being taken away. Brand builders need to be good marketers again. Our industry tends to get really narrowly focused on meta ads. And how do I hack meta ads? I've got a weird network of very large brand founders. All of them spend a lot of money on Meta. There's no question. But 100% of them generate a huge amount of demand off Meta that Meta captures. In other words, they're just good fucking marketers.
How did Spotlight Oral Care get 6 million views and over $30,000 in earned media value on TikTok? How did Plant People drive a 50% decrease in cost per add to cart and over a 30% increase in ROAS? To go big like these brands, you gotta think small and work with mini social micro influencers to create authentic UGC for your brand. Tired of hunting down and DMing creators on social, negotiating back and forth, only to have their one-off post flop and not impact your sales? Leave it to MiniSocial to handle all the nitty-gritty of booking the right creators for your brand, delivering top-quality content you can use across your ads and organic social media. Ready to try them out for yourself? Get 15% off your first project when you start in Q2. To claim your D2C listener discount, just go to dtc.minisocial.com.
Matt, welcome to the D2C podcast, man. I've been in your orbit following your journey for a really long time. I've worked at a few Kelowna companies. How you doing?
I'm all right, man. How you doing?
Doing really good here on a Wednesday afternoon. For those who may not be aware, I think probably a lot of people are aware of you through being the Canadian representative on the operators. So you don't have TikTok shops yet, maybe, but somebody's got to be that Canadian. That's us. So tell me a little bit about, for those who aren't familiar, give us a little walkthrough about your entrepreneur's hero's journey here.
I've been in this like e-commerce thing for 2008 on my own when I started my first company, which was on the services side. So like more agency, but design development. Actually, I started out like in the Magento world and then was a very early partner in Shopify. Kind of like when they were like first launching Shopify Plus, right? Is when like I was cutting my teeth on the design development side of this business. Built that company, bootstrapped it over a decade, sold it to private equity in 2018. They sold it again in 2021. And in 2017, I made what is the first investment in Pila Case, which is one of the brands we own. That was pre-revenue in 2017. It started to kind of really go in like 2018. And that's when I sold my first company. And then made the transition to like CEO of Pila Case. And then in 2021, we launched our second company, which is Lomi. So I've been everywhere in this e-commerce thing. I've been on the services side, supporting brands and retailers. Now I am running two brands. So I've like been on both sides of the coin. I'm one of the few who can like actually speak to, is the grass actually greener?
And is it, or is it just different? It's just different shades of green, depending on what side you're on, right?
The grass is green where you water it. There's no different. Like there's no better. It's just different. I think stage of career, all that good stuff. So I've been lucky enough to build and sell a company. Now I'm trying to build a bigger one. Hopefully sell it someday too. That's kind of the short story.
So did you build these products? I think it, from the way you sound, you acquired products in early or pre-revenue stages with Pila and Lomi. Did you build them from zero, or did you buy a product and scale them?
So Pila, I actually wrote the first angel check into. So my business partner's name is Jeremy. He's from Saskatchewan. He had invented the material and made the product, but still pre-revenue. So I fell in love with the story and the material. And like, you know, you go back to 2017, plastic was kind of like public enemy number one. There was turtles with straws in their nose. And like, it was just very topical, right? So, and I'm an outdoors guy. Like, you know, we both live in British Columbia, which is like, you kind of have to love the outside here. So I just sort of Yeah, I loved the story and what could be done with the material. I didn't really give a shit that it was a phone case, to be honest. I didn't care. I'm just like, that material's cool. Let's do something. So in that business, I was first money in. So we didn't buy the business. I just invested in it and then just continued to invest in it. And then we've raised, both companies are actually venture backed. So we've actually raised capital. Both are very R&D heavy. So they're one of the, I think they're like an edge case consumer focused business that should have outside capital. Most shouldn't. I'll say that up front. Loamy, we actually developed in-house. So we created that product from scratch. That was just an idea we had, developed it, did all the R&D for years, launched it ourselves, and then we spun that company out into its own entity. So we're kind of, we're structured almost quasi-holdco. So like we have one company, one cap table, and we have two operating businesses with two different teams. I'm kind of the, I'm the common ground between both businesses.
I don't think I fully under, like I don't, when we first chatted, I didn't quite get the full continuity between the two brands. And it wasn't until I was like looking at it today where I'm like, this is, it's such a good example of like that jobs to be done theory. And when you just said, hey, I bought it for the story.
Yep.
You know, or I was really into it for the story. And that's coming across in the podcast again and again, how important stories are. And it's part of the same story. It's, you just went deeper on the same story, on this waste, on this story of waste reduction, on yes. choking on waste and garbage. Loamy becomes like a proactive solution to actually addressing that, right?
It is. Like I joke around all the time that I'm like the internet, I'm like the first digital garbage man in the world, right? And it's, both companies are just trying to solve for waste. They're just attacking it a little differently. Like, the thesis with Pila is that that kind, like this new type of material science is going to replace traditional plastics, at least a good chunk of them. It won't be all of them. But that is a good, it is a good set of alternatives to a lot of like single use or short use plastic. So like, we have a long-term thesis on how that shakes out in that side of the business. So like Pila is mostly, let's prevent waste on the front end. So everyday products without everyday waste. Loamy was a, services and infrastructure play that sort of like starts out looking like a consumer product. No different than like if you look at Apple or Tesla, where like they started out as hardware or device, and those businesses evolve over time into services companies, right? So there's lots of stuff that gets built around the device. That's how we see Loamy evolving, is like it's more about food recycling than it is, oh, this is a consumer business. That's why like on our podcast, I mostly talk about Pila Case. Because to brand builders and consumer, it's the business that is relevant. The things that we do in Loamy as a company are highly irrelevant for most consumer companies. Like there's not a lot that you're going to learn from Loamy.
Because it's a system, right? Because it's like, it's sort of a recycling.
Yeah.
It's a whole mindset of having something in your kitchen.
It's an it's like we're taking the concept of a garbage truck and putting it in your kitchen. The green bin, the trash bin. We're just saying like, there's a better way to do this that doesn't involve an ever increasing number of trucks on the road, ever increasing landfills. We just think there's a different way to do this. So like our vision for the future is just very different from what it currently exists for most people in the world, right? So we have like R&D costs that consumer companies never see. Like half my staff in Loamy purely works in product development and R&D. You would never see that in a regular D2C brand.
Yeah. And it's funny, cases are like the prototypical, you know, phone cases were one of that biggest market segments that came out of the e-commerce revolution, right?
Yeah, man. It was like the drop shipping product. It was the print on demand thing. Like it was so commoditized so fast. And I was actually kind of like, I was attracted to it partly for that reason, because it is a bloody red ocean of a category. And we came into it as Pila, like, well, let's just create a new category of phone case. Everybody was focused on protection, you know, like, look, I can throw my phone out of a helicopter and like, no, I'll do it out of the Empire State. It was always just like the same stupid crap. So we came at it. We're like, well, what about the waste? You know, like 1.5 billion of these things get thrown away every year. That sounds like a good story. Like, let's go after that. So we've created the like sustainable mobile accessories category out of nothing. Like before us, there was nobody. There was nobody talking about it. Nobody even wanted to acknowledge it. But the more that we scratched around in the business, we're like, wow, this business is dirty. We liked it because it was like we could sell against that.
What's the difference between scaling Pella in 2024 versus 2010 through 2015? Like What's changed?
I mean, like, besides everything? I got involved in that brand in 2017, 2018. So it was still, you're at the tail end of like the golden era of Facebook ads. And I think we, in all honesty, we probably benefited from that in 2018 a little bit. You know, what has become more difficult for a company like Pila or Lomi in general is anytime you talk about climate, it's considered highly political in the online advertising world. So like Facebook, when Trump was going through the election, like out of that came all these new rules with advertising on Facebook. You know, if I talked about plastic in the ocean, that was considered too political. So we actually, for a long time, got kind of like handcuffed by Facebook for the kind of advertising we could do. So you fast forward to today, like when iOS 14 hit, by the way, Pila Case had already been kicked in the nuts. Like we were already down, like, because all the political crap basically gut punched us. So iOS 14 hit, and I'm like, ooh, big whoop, you know, like no big deal. We've already been punched. So not much change for us after that. Now, what's been nice is like the political environment calmed down, at least in climate. So we can run a lot more advertising on Facebook now than we used to be able to. And Meta has been sorting their shit out. So like where we are today, and I think kind of it's, we're no different in that brand than a lot of people. Like a lot of our marketing and growth comes from creator and influencer. So like we gift a lot of product. I've talked about that publicly. We just want to scale that out. For Pila in particular, like we have a really large recurring customer base. We've been around long enough that we move in phone cycles, right? So you buy a new phone every 3 years. What do you buy? Go get a case for it. So we're lucky that our product is good. People like it. They come back. So we benefit from like a big enough base that there's just natural word of mouth. Now for us, it's like, where does future growth in the brand come from? And really at our size, like category expansion isn't on the horizon. You know, like what do we use the material for outside of phone case? That's going to be both like our own products and probably licensed out, like where we license out the material with other brands and do collaborations. There's just a whole host of things that we can do at our size now.
But it's still the story that drives this. It's still a lot of that story about the product, about it being about waste reduction that really drives the product.
Yeah. I mean, look, the product, like that product is like, there's two reasons. I mean, there's probably a few reasons people buy it. So number one, we actually manufacture domestically. So like we manufacture that product right here in Kelowna. Most people don't even, like when you think of a phone case, it's like the quintessential made in Asia product, right? We are a made in Canada product. Probably, I would say we're probably the only domestic manufacturer, not printed, right? Like we actually mold the cases at our own facility here in Kelowna. So I think the like made local story works really well for a bunch of people. The climate and compostable sustainable story for sure. And then we lean on design, right? Like we drop designs once or twice a week because we are manufacturing domestically. Like we don't carry any inventory. We just make it as we sell it. So it's like a true on-demand inventory business, which is a great competitive advantage. And then the material is weirdly soft. So people tend to buy the product and get surprised by like how nice it feels relative to plastic. Those are sort of the four things that we push on for like core marketing messages.
Now, and it's still, is it the same channels that you're pushing them out on? Is it still the Metas, the Googles, anything going on TikTok?
Yeah. I mean, we've not, because a lot of reasons, but we're a premium priced product. We've not found a lot of success on TikTok. That's probably going to change this year. I think we've got an idea of how we unlock that particular channel. Our customer tends to skew sort of like 25 to 35, not 15 to 25. Like a lot of other mobile companies go after like young girls. We typically are like post-college, like, you know, 25 to 40 on the high end women, lots of moms. So Facebook, Instagram is like the main thing for us.
So between Pila and Lomi, what's a big learning, or either talk about like a mistake that was made with Pila that you haven't duplicated in Lomi, or like a big win in Pila that you have duplicated?
I mean, the funny thing is like we initially came up with the idea for Lomi on this thesis that we had like all these customers in Pila, right? And when we launched Lomi, it came out of the gates like super strong, except that the customer was like a 55 45-year-old, like 47 to 65-year-old single family homeowner.
Yeah.
And it was not the Peel audience at all. So we had built this whole, our whole business plan was built on, we have an existing audience that loves sustainability and climate. Let's go give them another product. And we completely missed the mark on who we thought the customer would be. What actually, like, and that was part of our, like, we launched Loamy inside of Pila thinking like, this is one company. And as we built them out, we realized like, no, Loamy is actually a different customer with a completely set of different set of distribution channels. Like, it's not even, it will not even be that big of a consumer business in the long run. It's going to be a much bigger B2B business. So it's sort of, we got a little caught a little flat-footed, and then I think we got lucky in that it was successful in spite of our mistake.
Interesting. I like what you said. I don't think I realized about the contentiousness of environmental advertising over the last 5 years. I think that's a really interesting point. And what I like about your, like, because I feel like there is an aspect of like greenwashing at times that comes 100%. Into the space.
Yeah.
But not with your products in a way, right? Because your products are physical manifestations of taking waste out of the environment one way or the other. It's hard for you to get hit with that rap, right?
Yeah. I mean, look, we get attacked all the time by competitors. Even in Loamy, it's like, that's greenwashing. I'm like, no. Like, we've third party validation on carbon footprint. Like, it's not greenwashing, promise. Lots of smart people that, you know, have accreditations have said it's not. It's funny, the Loamy gets attacked more than Pila Case now. Pila Case got attacked for a long time as being greenwashing. The main attack was who can compost a phone case, right? So like, who cares? Just throw the plastic in the garbage. They're going to throw yours in the garbage. And like, that's a ridiculous argument, right? That was like, I remember early days building Pila Case, like we would get criticized that you're greenwashing because nobody can compost. And I mean, that's true because in the United States, they have no infrastructure for composting. It's why we built Loamy. But that attack wound up being hilarious to me because I remember, I'm old enough to remember the early days of electric cars, like pre-Tesla. And the argument against electric cars was always like, well, there's too many gas stations. Like, electric cars aren't going to be a thing. I mean, where are we today, right? So like, every time we get attacked for a greenwashing angle, like right now with Loamy, it's like, well, it plugs in and you could just have like a backyard bin that composts your food. I'm like, well, that's true. And if you can do that, great. But like, most people don't. If it was so easy, they would. And if it was so convenient, they would. So like, yeah, it plugs in, but it's also the only carbon negative appliance in your home ever. So like, that's not greenwashing. There's just a cohort of people out there that are just angry at anything technology. And Loamy is a very nice target for that. We even made a video about it where the hook was like, you know, do you still do your laundry like it's 1820, right? Like, or do you have a lot, or do you have a washing machine and a dryer? Because if you have a washing machine and a dryer and you're pissed off at Loamy for using electricity to take care of your food waste, like, you're a hypocrite. Wash your damn clothes by hand, you know, if you're so fucking hardcore. So like, I think the greenwashing thing, even though we're pure in our intentions, we still get attacked for it.
Yeah.
And we're pretty damn buttoned up.
Some people are just a-holes. I saw your recent tweet about starting a list of a-hole customers, the people that do false chargebacks. And as someone who sold a lot of info or, you know, education in my day,
yep,
the amount of people, like every time someone, you know, rips off your course, you know, or buys your course and then puts it on one of the pirate networks, they almost always charge it back as well, which is just the double fuck you.
Yeah. So fuck those guys. In consumer, I think it's tricky, right? Cause like I think we're actually still in this golden era of building consumer businesses where a lot of barriers have come way, way low. I actually think like I have days where I feel like the barriers to entry to build a consumer business are too low. Like it's too easy to start a Shopify store. Like, I don't know if you saw on Twitter the other day, but like Sean from Ridge, like had to publicly tweet to Shopify, like somebody's knocking me off. They put their address as the freaking Chinese consulate. So I can't even send my lawyers to sue them because it's a false address. And there's no way to take them down. I think the barriers have come so far down now that we have a lot of bad actors on the product and the brand building side. And then I also think that sophistication and fraud has gotten so high. And there's solutions like Count and stuff that have come out to help battle fraud. But dude, like the online forums where people gather to figure out how to rip companies off are, it's disgusting. Like, it's the lowest of low of human beings, in my opinion. And they come across, and the funny thing is like, if you've ever had to battle fraud at scale, these people are very savvy. So like, I tweeted it out that like, I think Shopify should actually take a stand here. And I was going after more like just shitty asshole customers, because I feel awful for my customer service team sometimes that like, you know, somebody will open a chat or an email, and if you don't respond in 30 minutes, they're like jumping down your throat online. And I'm just like, when did we get this? Like, where did we lose the humanity of commerce? You know, like, I grew up in a retail family. So like, I always just experienced like the good humanity of commerce. And as a brand builder who's like trying to do good in the world, it drives me nuts that the default assumption is that you're a company and you're trying to rip me off as a consumer in some people's minds. Right. And I think that there's a cohort of consumer out there that's just a genuine, terrible customer, and that Shopify has the data to see 90% of this person's purchases wind up in a return. Maybe they should be flagged. Like, they have that data, right, at scale. And as a brand, I would love it, like, as a tool. Not, I think that like people like Count and even Shopify have fraud type prevention. I'm talking about more just, that's just a bad customer that I don't want.
Do you ever build, it's funny, this takes me back to the first conference I ever put on in Berlin, and my friend Paul Jayapal, local e-commerce entrepreneur in town here, gave a talk about, one of the things he mentioned was actually creating lists, like block lists, for your Facebook ads of negative customers, and actually creating negative lookalike lists. I don't know if this is something people do anymore, but actually like take the negative customers you know about. Is that something that works anymore? I don't know.
So for advertising, for a long time, we would exclude interest groups, like lists for sure. We had lists, like exclusion lists, because we wanted to avoid like the trolling side of the internet. I mean, dude, if you find a Lomi ad, you will just find an immense amount of trolls that go after that product. It's hilarious. I'm just like, get a life, man.
Do you block them? Do you delete their comments, or do you try to win them back in the comments?
Nah, you can't win back, stupid. So like,
no,
don't even try. Right. And I'm also like, I believe that like a sign of a great product is one that has like a very visceral reaction one way or the other. If your product just gets like a milk toast type response, that's not good.
Yeah.
So I kind of like that there's that Lomi and Pila have both like evoked this negative response from a lot of folks. It tells me that we're onto something, because for every shithead, there's also like five people being like, no, I have one. I love it. Like, what are you talking about? I will tell my team, like, you can go ahead and delete a comment where somebody is just being rude or racist or like just an indignant type comment. Half the time they're bots and crap anyway. But you know, like, I don't believe we all have to sit there and take it as brands. Like, it's a free speech goes both ways, right? And freedom of choice goes both ways. Like, we do not have to serve everybody as companies. I believe that to my core. Like, every company should be able to say, like, nope, I don't want to sell to you. Nope, I don't need to be for everyone. That, like, this is who I am for. If that angers you or you don't like that I'm also here to serve you, too bad. Go to the next guy. Like, that's what a free market economy is for.
I really love that you brought up this idea that we're still in the golden age, because I think I've been in the industry close to as long as you have in one way or the other. And it's easy to look back on the heydays and when the Pixel was better and when ads were cheaper and all these things. But what's your advice to a D2C listener who maybe hasn't started a brand yet? Like, what would be your advice about where to focus on if someone wanted to start a D2C brand?
Like, go study old companies. So like, learning from brands that were started in like 10 years ago in the, like, those golden years of Facebook ads, that is not who you should learn from. You want to learn from people who had to learn how to market product before Facebook made it dumb shit easy, right? Because now the toy is kind of being taken away. And now we as brand builders need to be good marketers again. And there are decades and decades of great marketers and great brands to study. And I think that our industry tends to get really narrowly focused on meta ads. And how do I hack meta ads? And I can tell you, like, I've got a weird network of very large brand founders in my life. All of them spend a lot of money on meta. There's no question. But 100% of them generate a huge amount of demand off meta that meta captures. In other words, they're just good fucking marketers.
Yeah.
So like, if you're starting out, be a good marketer. Forget being a good meta ads person.
It just doesn't work in the, you know, when you've got a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And I, you know, that's something I've said on the podcast a lot lately. And the thing that I'm talking about more and more, almost every episode these days, is this idea of true top of funnel demand generation. Whereas like for years, I've thought of Facebook as, you know, prospecting campaigns as top of funnel activity, but really it just compresses everything into one direct response funnel, right?
That's demand capture. You know, yeah. Most people who make meta ads work at scale exist in large TAM categories. They sell shoes. They sell t-shirts to dudes. They sell makeup. Like, they sell supplements. Like, man, you show me somebody spends a lot of money on meta, I will show you a large TAM.
Yeah.
Right? For a problem that people are in market for. And that's a wonderful way to build a business, right? That means that you can like focus on capturing demand and you don't need to worry about generating demand. There's a lot of companies out there who do need to think about demand gen, and that when you start a business, it's not easy to just go and fire up ads. Some people can, like, you can definitely funnel hack your way to a decent sized business if that's your goal. But if your goal is longevity and sustainability of business and like building something of value, then you kind of need to make a great product and you need to learn how to tell a great story, regardless of the tool or tactic being used.
You kind of mentioned with Pelicase at this point being a bit of a rolling thunder based on the amount of customers you guys already have. But with Lomi, you would have had to go back to, you'd have to educate people on like a new product
that a lot of them don't even know exists.
Yep. So how are you doing that? What's been most effective for demand gen on the Lomi side?
I mean, out of the gate, YouTube, I think, like, again, like, let's just look like what makes for, how do you take a product like that? What is good marketing for this type of product, right? We're creating a new category. Nobody's ever even thought to buy something like this. So there is a high education component to this, long purchase consideration cycles. And our customer tends to be older, right? Like, our average age on Lomi is 47. A third of my customers are over the age of 65. So, or 60, not 65. So all that as context, right? We have actually found the most success in demand generation on television. I know a lot of people have like very strong opinions on this, but for this product in a new category creation mode, for the kind of customer we're going after, TV is a high trust, high reach channel.
Yep.
That frankly, like, if you know anybody in their 60s, they don't trust a Facebook ad like they do the television spot that ran next to a Johnson & Johnson spot. It's a different animal, right? Like, and I know that pisses a lot of Facebook advertisers off, but if you think about it from a marketing and a psychology, it makes sense. You know, like, my cohort for Lomi ads, like, somebody's on the Food Network or HGTV and they see a Lomi ad, they don't then see some scammy shithead selling you like dick pills next.
Yeah.
Right? Like, the feed of ads on television is quite pure and quite wholesome, and they see things they know. It's forward.
Yep.
Like, I've seen a number of Lomi ads where I'm like, it's on Sports Network or whatever. It's like in the middle of a tennis match and there's like a Lomi ad and then there's like Dodge Ram. Great, great next to like person to be next to from a trust transference. I look at, like, sometimes I see a Lomi ad on Facebook and I keep scrolling and I see something that I'm like, that is so bad. and I'm like, if I'm a 62-year-old grandma who is a customer of mine, right? Like, what is the association? So for Lomi, it's a different animal. And that's why I say, like, for a lot of D2C people, we might not be the best person to look at. But I also think that there's too much dogma around Facebook ads or bust.
I fully agree. When you talk about TV too, going after that older audience, I'm interested about the creative. Are you doing, because like there'd be a couple ways to shoot Lomi. Like you could do it like the Apple product of so-and-so, or you could do it like, oh, have you ever tried to use a compost? You know, like those old infomercial style of like big X through the way you used to do it versus how you now do it. What balance are you striking with the creative on Lomi for TV?
I mean, we test on digital first. So like, again, I'm such a fan of digital. I always come across as like the curmudgeon-y dude that hates Facebook ads. I don't. I love it. I spend a lot of time in Facebook ads. A lot of money there. Still my biggest spender for Pila. Not on Lomi, but it's still a big spender. We test digital first, right? We do a lot of shooting and editing ourselves. Always have. We've tested infomercial. We've tested like brandy, the problem solution, like really beautiful stuff. Lomi's price point customer, the more beautiful, the more branded, the better. That's a broad statement. There's obviously exceptions to everything I'm saying. You know, oddly enough, even Pila, like I will say, like the higher quality ads always perform well for Pila, or perform more often than the like shitty looking ugly ads.
Yeah.
So for TV, we typically run like a 30-second spot. It's well shot, narrated. Yeah, it's just, it's a good looking spot. It looks like a good TV ad. It's built for that platform.
You recently published a script or one of your posts recently talked about like how you think about approaching video ads in general in terms of narrative. Is that what you applied from Lomi as well?
Yes. So I'm just a fan of like proven copywriting frameworks, like ADA, right? So like I don't like to reinvent the wheel. I don't try to get cute. It's, you know, there's a lot of history and a lot of great marketing for many, many decades. I just try to use what they've done. I'm a really good rip off and duplicate marketer.
Yeah. It reminds me of Ryan McKenzie's first ad for True Earth that he made on, you know, iMovie or whatever. And it just told you about the problem. Here's the solution. He used stock footage. And I think it carried them for their first like 10 million of sales or something like that, right?
I have the text message that when Ryan sent me that video, because when I remember him shooting it himself in his laundry room, and he's like, look at this piece of shit. He's like, I'm going to try this tomorrow.
Yeah.
Right. And it worked, but it was a good ad. Like structurally, it was a good ad. So and the quality of it, who cares? It was just a good ad. It got your attention. It hit you with like some interest. There's a problem. There's some desire. Like it was a good ad. You know, no wonder it worked for a long time.
Yeah. You mentioned also the enterprise side or the B2B side of Lomi. When I moved into my place here, I was, you know, the city gave me a bin and it's disgusting right now. I don't like it. How do you get Lomi to be the thing that cities provide their citizens?
I think we're a long way away from that at scale. I think there's like smaller towns and municipalities that will do that first simply because they don't have the trucking infrastructure to do the alternative. But I think that over time, as like the cost of this technology comes down, becomes more ubiquitous, also more and more people are buying it directly and then telling their cities, like, why don't you just roll this out? You know, there's a push for less garbage trucks on the road. I honestly think the answer to that question is time. And, you know, we're 2.5 years into building Lomi. Like really, we launched a crowdfund in April of 2021 and I didn't deliver the product to people until March of 2022. So we're a month away from it being 2 years of people having these things in their homes, you know, and now we've got competition. And I think that that's going to help with maturity and just signals to all of it needs to happen. You know, like what people don't realize about waste and what excites me about it is like, it is a like multi-trillion dollar category globally. It's old, it's slow, it's got lots of big companies.
It's built on lies. It's all built on people's misconceptions. It's all bullshit. It's like 5% of all plastic is ever recycled, right?
Recycling's the biggest lie of the last 50 years, easily. There's just a lot of cloak and dagger because the industry's got its roots in like freaking The Sopranos and you know, like it's a joke.
Waste management.
Yeah. But it's kind of also true. So I think there's, you know, there's been a lot of, I guess like maturing and legitimizing of the business of waste. But I got to be honest, the more I learn about it, the more I realize like there's still a lot of backroom dealing and a lot of lobbyists and a lot of BS. Like I think even here in Canada, I don't remember which companies got called out for it, but like one of our TV stations or reporters put trackers in like in a bunch of waste, and they watched it get picked up by these like haulers that say it's being recycled. And I think only one of the three wound up in an actual recycling facility. One of them went to an incinerator and one of them went straight to a landfill. It yeah. didn't even pass through like, hey, maybe we should sort this, right to landfill. It's all a bunch of lies. That broadly for plastic, where I think credit is due is like paper is highly recycled. Yep. Glass is great. Steel can be great, like metals. So it's really plastic. Plastic has been perverted to a point where while it's like the miracle material of the last 100 years, it's also hell. And those two things can be true at the same time, right? And I think that like, I like to make this point because too much of our world is all about polarizing things. I'm not anti-plastic. I'm anti it should be used in everything. That's it, right? Like cars. Cars today would not be nearly as fuel efficient if it wasn't for plastic. Good use. But like, should your bananas be individually wrapped in cellophane? No.
They have a wrapper.
Like, it's fucking skin. So like, I'm more like, can we just be reasonable and have a conversation about this stuff? And when there is alternatives, like how do we go about changing those out? And what does this transition look like? I guess I'm getting old and I just want to have more rational debate with people.
It's got to be nuanced because either side will then straw man the other person's most nefarious argument.
I know.
And they'll try to pin you to the worst possible interpretation of what you're putting out there. It's brutal.
We had a YouTuber for Peel a Case. This dude, what a dipshit in Calgary. I'll just call him that. Like, what an ass. He took a Peel a Case in Calgary. You're from Canada, okay? He buried it in his yard in like the coldest fucking climate in North America and was like, dug it up 6 months later. He's like, look, it didn't compost. I'm like, number one, that's not how compost works. You have to stick it in the ground, ass. Like that's not what it is. So he's a real YouTuber with a big audience, and he took this shot at us and made it look like we were just lying to people. And my team was just like, wow, like they got so mad, right? And I was laughing and I'm like, guys, but this is where the world is right now. Like he's incentivized to get views and sell advertising on his YouTube videos. We're a nice, tasty target because we spend a lot of dollars on marketing, right? And it's like, it's fun to go take a shot at us. And, you know, and it's happened once, maybe twice, right? Where like these big YouTubers who are just angry men take a shot at us and we laugh. We're like, you know, we're carbon neutral certified. Everything's life cycle analysis. We make no claims. We can't back. Like just, we're so buttoned up and yet everybody likes to come after us.
But you're also a big YouTube guy now with the operators. How much fun are you having on the operators? I really enjoy the podcast. The personalities are great. How did it come about and how much are you enjoying it?
Dude, it's a ton of fun. I get to hang out with my friends and just talk shop, right?
Shoot the shit.
Yeah, man. And it's like, we've all got day jobs that take our priority. So like the hard part of it is just scheduling because we're all very busy, but it's so much fun. And it kind of like, I mean, it came about, we Sean and I were chatting about doing a show and then we met the producer of the show, Finn. Finn's like, I think you guys should make this a thing, get four of you together. Like the format could work. This doesn't exist. So like, take a crack at it, right? And we're like, okay, let's commit to 10 episodes. And now we're kind of coming up on 50 in the next little bit. And it's funny, like I come away from most episodes where I've learned something that I can actually use in my business. So from that angle, I'm like, what a great use of an hour of my time. And then I get to meet like the network and like the access and all the stuff that comes, like it's just so valuable for our companies that you get to have fun and it's like, it's valuable for the core business that you're working on. It just, to me, it's a no brainer, right? It helps with recruiting. It's just like, it's so much fun from all angles.
And you're doing a good job. It's funny, like it's similar modeled a little bit on the All In podcast, right? And they started talking about business. Now they've verged pretty heavily into the political landscape. How do you guys balance? You guys stick straight about business? You don't mess around with politics at all?
We're trying to stay away from politics. Every now and again, it's just like, it's hard not to talk about it. It's like the every now and again, it's like there's a car crash right in front of your face. It's difficult not to talk about the car crash. But you know, our hope for the show, I mean, I don't even think we have a plan. I think it's like our hope, at least my hope for the show, is that it appeals to a broader and broader audience just around what it's like to run real companies, like real business. You know, part of the inspiration, like part of the reason I wanted to do it was because of, like, I'm a huge fan of the All In pod, but like that's one perspective on the world, right? Out of like a very vacuum bubbly place that is
pretty detached from the average person in a lot of ways, right?
Totally. Like, yeah. And you talk to like your average business owner is just not going to learn a lot from those guys. I think like consumer is a normal business, and it's actually a really hard normal business. Like D2C is hard, and like making physical things and moving them around the world is hard. There's a reason why on the All In show, they're always talking about no SaaS. Don't get into the world of stuff. It's too difficult. There's cogs. They're scared of cogs. So I think when you look at like the average small business in North America or globally, they are not building SaaS companies that are venture scaled. Most of us have to deal with like people face to face. Most of us have cost of goods sold. So my hope for the show is that we like just bring a lot of real operators together and that we learn collectively and that like we can make better business owners. And try to stay like Finn's always telling us, that producer is like, you know, stay upmarket with the content. Don't go cater to the like internet marketing, make money on the internet, biz oppy, scammy type bullshit. Like, you see them all. Like none of us are ever, I don't think any of us are ever going to be like, check out my Ferrari or like all that. Like none of that. The closest we'll get is like, we'll talk about building houses and shit, but man, like really, who, that's a home.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to just try to stay like true to this. What is it like to build a real company? What are the problems that you run into? And then can we try to be helpful? And honestly, like there's a ton of fun in that, man.
I love it. It's funny. My First Million is another one of my favorite ones, and they do a great job of staying upmarket with business owners.
Like Sean and Sam are good. Like, yeah, I like him. I'm in a text group with Sean because he's got an e-commerce business, and like, smart dude, man. Like, really smart dude. And like, they clearly, both of them are brilliant. I like the show. I actually like, and it, I referred, I've got a 15-year-old nephew in Calgary who's like, I want to learn about being an entrepreneur. He's like, where do I start? I'm like, go back to episode 1. Of this show and just start listening.
I 100% agree. I went to their live event one time and I met like D2C founders and SaaS people. And I met two guys that ran a tow truck company. And it's just like, when you can go upmarket, everyone, you know, so many people have a product to sell, whether they're a real estate agent and it's their own product or whatever. Like I think staying, and that's one thing we've done on this, with this podcast is very much like D2C, e-commerce, marketing. And so we're kind of mid-market, I think a little bit, but I think we're interested to find ways to kind of open up the funnel and bring
people in. I had a guy from Alberta, like who owns an oil services company who listens to the Operators Pod.
Nice.
That like sent me a message on LinkedIn. I'm like, that's cool. Like, that's super cool. Like, you've got a real world, like blue collar business. And it's a big company too. That's the kind of person that we want to talk to.
Nice. Well, you want to hear more from Mr. Matthew Bertulli, you got to go check out the Operators Podcast. Thanks for coming on today, man. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, man. Take care.
Thanks so much for listening to today's episode. If you're not a subscriber to our newsletter, you can do that right now at directtoconsumer.co. I'm Eric Dick, and this has been the D2C Podcast. We'll see you next time.